From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A barrel of oil costs more than $143. Nationally, folks are paying a record $4.09 per gallon of gas. That is record-setting, break-the-bank money. So can you finger anyone with the blame? Oil speculators, for one, and how are folks coping? This week on News and Notes, we're doing a special multimedia series called Road Trippin' that gets to all of these issues with plenty of personal stories. Here to kick things off is economics contributor Bill Spriggs. He's chair of the economics department at Howard University. Bill, good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
So before we dive too deep into oil, I heard something pretty incredible about the finances. Analysts are saying that June has been the worst month for the stock market since the Great Depression. Do you think that that's true, and how would they be calculating those numbers?
They're talking about in terms of a percentage drop, so that's the way that they're making the comparison. And so, yes, it's true. And it's the market discounting information about the future. We know that General Motors and Ford are going to be in trouble because of declining auto sales. And we know that the airlines are going to be in trouble as they cut back to adjust to higher fuel oil costs. So this is the market sort of forecasting where things are going to be. They're troubled with the financials. They're worried about the amount of capital that many banks and investment banking houses have had to raise. So they're showing their concerns about the future.
I've noticed my own 401ks getting hit by this, because when you have things invested in the market, even passively through retirement funds, you get to see them fall. Now, this is a question that's a little bit off from what I was going to ask, but at one point, I was talking to someone who was nearing retirement, who was very concerned about the fluctuations in the market. Would you have any advice, or, you know, what would you say to someone who was like, what should I do? Should I pull all my money out and put it in bonds if you are nearing retirement age?
Well, if you're near retirement, you shouldn't be in the stock market if you're that close to retirement anyway. You can't really deal with the short-term fluctuations. But this roller coaster ride that we had, the bust of the dot-com bubble in 2001 and now this roller coaster ride down again, signifies why individuals have a hard time taking on market risk. And when you hear people say that, well, we should privatize Social Security, it's precisely this type of risk that individuals can't handle, that we have Social Security, and why it's not such a good idea to privatize that risk.
At the end of this week, we're also going to see new unemployment numbers. What do you predict for that?
We've had five straight months of declines. I think we're going to see another month of decline, maybe not as severe. The stimulus package helped out retailers quite a bit. So hopefully the number won't be too bad, but it's likely that we're going to continue this slide.
All right, Bill, let's get to the meat of the issue we mentioned at the top, which is oil, oil and gas. Speculation, what is that? Who would be an oil speculator, and what would that job entail?
Well, there are a number of ways in which people can enter into the oil market. Speculators can enter into it by trying to buy futures contracts, which say that I will agree to buy so much oil in the future. For delivery in September, as an example. These are highly leveraged purchases. Normally, they're buying an option. So they're buying an instrument that says, I have the right to buy. This allows them to put a small amount of money down, and for small movements in price, they gain a lot. And so the type of leverage that's involved encourages speculation. The gamble that you have if you're a speculator is because you don't really want the oil, that you bid up the price to the point where you can't find someone who then wants to buy the contract from you, and you get stuck with lots
actual
of barrels
oil.
Of oil that you don't have any use for. So that's the gamble. In the short run, it's not that much of a gamble, though, because the people who really need oil, if you're an airline, if you're a railroad company, if you're a major utility company, you have to have oil. You know that you have so many flights that you have to fly. You have so many trains that you have contracted to run. And so you have to buy the oil. So a speculator actually gets to move the price up, forcing those who really need the oil to match that new price.
Is that one of the reasons why oil is so expensive?
Well, it's very curious. Those who want to say it's pure market forces have to explain why the price seemed to spike just at the time that the housing market crashed in the United States, and we know people fled putting money into the housing market. And then the question becomes, where did they put those billions of dollars if they took them out of housing? And a lot of people believe that that money went into oil speculation. People like to put money into commodities when the markets look bad. Normally it's gold, but gold is a fixed thing. You can only bid up the price of gold so much. Then there's black gold, which is a lot more liquid and easy to dispose of. And so a lot of people think that's where the money went. People say, well, it can't be speculation because if people are speculating, they'll get the price way above what the end users really would want to pay. And as a result, we should see rising inventories. Well, actually, we have seen rising inventories. The first quarter, when you look month over month, shows that the OECD, which are the industrialized countries, show an increasing number of days of oil supply on hand. If it really was supply and demand, we would expect tight markets. We would expect inventories to drop to some dramatic level if that were the case.
What about the government? And what I mean by that is that there's multiple bills in Congress right now about, you know, tightening up regulations on oil speculators. Do you think this is really an issue where the government needs to get involved?
I think so. I think it is an area where, again, letting the market do what the market wants to do isn't necessarily getting to what economists believe. Economists believe that people are in that oil market are suppliers and demanders of oil, not somebody trying to manipulate the price. So to the extent we can get those folks out of the marketplace, we would all be better off. It's a difficult thing to see because the oil market is kind of complex. Some of the inventory buildup can actually just be oil staying in the ground. As an example, oil production in the United States in the first quarter actually was down over last year. When people say we need to have more drilling, well, we have oil companies with the right to drill. We have them lowering the amount that they're pulling out of the ground at the moment compared to last year. So more drilling doesn't seem to be the answer. It's something more complex going on.
Well, speaking of drilling, there's a lot of land that is actually owned by the government which could be used to drill oil. There's a, if you talk about offshore drilling on U.S. coast, there's a 27-year moratorium on a lot of U.S. coast drilling. What do you think politicians are going to do? There was that huge fight over ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, back and forth over whether or not you could drill there. But in general, do you think those kinds of fights are going to break out between different branches of government?
Those fights are going to break out because it sounds like a solution, but we know from history that that's not going to be a solution for right now. The oil that we allowed to come out of Prudhomme Bay in Alaska is just now making a difference in the marketplace, and that was almost 20-some years ago. So if we do something with drilling rights today, you're not going to see that oil for another 20 years. So that's not going to change the price of oil anytime soon. People may want to give in to that because it sounds like a solution, but it's a solution way off. It's not going to answer today's problem.
What are Senators McCain and Obama's stance on offshore drilling?
Well, McCain has reversed himself. Initially, he opposed that. He, of course, has tended to be strong on environmental issues, but now he has decided that he would rather give in on the idea of letting drilling take place offshore. On the case of Senator Obama, he has been very a suspect that increased drilling isn't going to answer the problem, that we need a long-term solution for what we need down the road, but more immediately that speculators probably do need to be reined in and we need to be a lot more careful about what they're doing in the marketplace.
If you put on your crystal ball, take it out, take a look, what do you see ahead in the next 6 months or a year in terms of fuel prices, whether it's gas or jet fuel, et cetera?
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. The U.S. slowed up during the first quarter, And yet we saw the price of oil go up. And the idea that demand is driving it means that you're saying that China and India are growing at such a rapid rate that they're making up for the slowdown in the U.S. economy. We can see that in the future, the airlines have already cut back, announced cutbacks on the number of flights they're going to have in the fall. We know that auto production is down, that people are making switches out of SUVs and trucks and into smaller cars. So the demand for oil is going to drop even more than it has the first quarter of this year. It's hard to see how high prices are going to sustain themselves in the face of the drawbacks that people are making both at the pump and that companies are making like airline companies.
All right, Bill. Great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks.
Bill Spriggs is the chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. He's also the co-author of Beyond the Mountaintop, King's Prescription for Poverty. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. 5 years ago, the price of oil was just below $25 a barrel. The average price of a gallon of gas was less than $2. Flash forward to June 2008, now a barrel of oil costs more than $140. I don't have to tell you what that's meant for the price at the pump. So we went out this week and talked with a few people at a local gas station. Here is what Los Angelino David Knight had to say.
We're hurting out here. This gas ain't playing, man. I mean, $80 to fill up a tank? Come on. And how many times a day a person might have to do that if they're out here trying to make a living? It ain't right.
If gas prices are bringing you down, then you might take some comfort in knowing the blues are sweeping the nation. Cities, businesses, and families are all feeling the crunch. According to Wayne Hockwater, it's also affecting moods. Wayne is a professor of management at Florida State University's College of Business. He has been studying how $4 a gallon gas brings out the worst in people. Wayne, how you doing?
Nice chatting with you.
Well, you know, how did you get the idea to look at this from a psychological perspective?
Well, I actually started this whole stream of research when gas was about $3 a gallon, and certainly that piqued my interest through the surveys and through casual observations with people, and I just continued to see on people's faces just this pain, this difficulty, this worry, and certainly it's my intention to explore that more fully because it is something that is a legitimate issue, not just for businesses, but for American society.
So you talk about this as a control issue. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we know about stress is that if you can have some control over it, it's not so bad. You know, if you need to lose some weight and you have a personal trainer, that's your control. You're going to be okay. But I think the things that are really affecting people the most, I think there are three things. One is there's really no getting around gasoline for a lot of people, despite public transportation, riding your bikes. A lot of people, they just don't have that option. I mean, it's just not viable. The second thing, as you mentioned, is it's a matter of control. People can't do anything about it. They can't barter the price down. They can't, you know, they can't manage it themselves. They're just tremendously helpless feeling. And I think the third thing that is equally important is the people that I talk to, if you ask them to look down the road 6 months or a year, they're very pessimistic. I mean, they simply don't see this situation or their financial situation getting any better. So, you know, if you told folks that, hey, look, January 1st, things are going back to $1.50, folks would be okay. But they're really, for a lot of people, there is very little end in sight, and that's very disheartening.
You know, we measure consumer confidence, but do we have any other ways of really measuring the psychological health of people who are citizens in terms of what they buy?
Well, I mean, it's as far as purchase patterns, I can only say one thing, and that my family and I happened to be at Disney World a couple of Saturdays ago, and it was empty. So I think that's part of it. But as far as measuring people's just mental health, you have to look at doctor's visits. You have to look at absenteeism at work. You have to look at all those things that are consequences of just feeling disheartened, overwhelmed, pessimistic about the future, and kind of go from there.
Now, are people placing the blame any one place, like the government or the oil industry? I mean, when you talk to people, do they have a target for their unhappiness?
Every place. They target every place, because most folks, this is such a popular topic in the news and the media that people are forming their own opinions of who to blame, and there's really no shortage of culprits in this case. And some folks blame big oil, of course. Others blame our current administration and prior administrations for getting us into this mess. And a lot of folks really don't blame anybody. They are just trying to figure out ways to manage, and where are they going to cut, and how are they going to reschedule vacations that were going to require 10 hours of driving and into an hour and a half and 2 hours of driving. People feel like they don't have a say and they can't do anything about it. So blaming people is kind of a moot point.
Now, speaking of these psychological effects of gas prices, what do you think happens when the price of gas goes up by 50 cents and then it comes down again by, say, 5 cents? Does something that small overall, does it brighten people's mood?
Not unless it comes down 5 cents every week for 50 weeks. No. I mean, people are in tune to the trend that they've been experiencing, because every 3 days they've got to live with it. I mean, they've got to pull into the gas station and they know what they're paying. In fact, the 5 cent reductions in costs, most people look at that and say, they're just playing with us now. They're trying to get our hopes up that this is going to go down and this is a little bit better, and it's going to lessen my blues, and I'm going to get on track. No, that 5 cents per gallon reduction doesn't do anything.
All right, Wayne, thanks for talking to us.
It's a pleasure. Have a great one.
You too.
Thank you.
Wayne Hockwater is a professor of management at Florida State University's College of Business, and he has been studying the psychological effects of gas prices.
You know, I'm a substitute teacher, and I used to take off a day or two and say, well, I'm not going to work today. You know, this was prior to this gas problem. Now I have to do it every day. I have to go to work. It's like it's a hopeless situation, because someone said that by Labor Day, it would be up to something like $6.50. I believe that, truly.
Those are comments from Paulette, with whom we caught up at the pump last week. You might say people hit hardest by the gas crisis are people who work in their vehicles. There are almost 6,000 taxi drivers in Washington, D.C. That's more cabs per capita than any other city. Carolyn Robinson is a taxi driver there, or as she's fond of saying, a public service vehicle operator. And she's with us now. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi.
So how much do you pay for gas each day?
Well, it varies, probably depending on how the need I have for working. I can use yesterday as an example. I have to use high test gas because I have a Lincoln Town Car, and high test is roughly $3.35 to $3.59 a gallon. And I purchased $80 in gas yesterday, and I worked somewhat extensively. And I have less than a half a tank left now.
How'd you get into this business?
Well, I've been driving a cab now for 33 years. Really, my husband, due to some, I guess, either unfortunate or fortunate circumstances, was involved. Someone got him involved. Basically, when he was in the halfway house. And he decided to get involved. And I was at home with the kids, and I said that I need to do that, and he didn't think I could do it. And I successfully passed the test.
You proved him wrong.
Yes.
So you, how many days a week do you drive, generally?
Every day.
Yeah, really?
There's some days, I mean, I'm not necessarily always working every day. I mean, I have other responsibilities. I have a 85-year-old mother that I have to take back and forth to the doctors, and, you know, and I have a granddaughter that I might have to pick up from school or from daycare. But I work mostly during the evening because I work with Yellow Cab Company, and they have contracts with a lot of the law firms. So their attorneys or their support staff, when they work past a certain hour, then they get a free taxi ride home.
And they're getting the town car, which is the nice big fancy car that you provide, but it probably eats up a fair amount of gas. So, you know, just to put this in context, have you seen your bottom line after all this gas get smaller? I mean, you're taking
pay. Absolutely, absolutely. It causes you, because first of all, in the District of Columbia, regulations state that we have to burn our air conditioner from May to, you know, September. So with the gas, that's yesterday, it was the reason that I had to put extra gas in the car also, because I happened to have a job that was going to Dulles International, which is 32 miles from downtown. So that's 32 miles over and 32 miles back. And now I really saw the reduction, because with our new system, we have a new meter system, and we got a decrease in the mileage, 30 cents a mile. So when it would ordinarily, it would be a lucrative $55 to $60 run, now it's just a $40, a $45 run. Mm. But then I still have to put additional gas in my car, you know, so.
And the meters, really, you have to actually pay for your own new meters, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. That was something, yes, we had to pay for our own meters. This was a ruling that the mayor made under the auspices of Senator Levin, which personally that was, I believe, some type of rider on the school takeover for the public schools, for the mayor taking over the schools. So the cab drivers had to feel the brunt of that. So they decided that we needed meters, but they didn't have any finances for the meters. So that was really an additional, you know, an additional cost, because the meters cost roughly $500.
Carolyn, you know, do you think that any of your fellow drivers will go out of business based on what's going on?
Oh, absolutely, because most of us are not getting a fair return on our investment. We have additional fees. You know, we pay weekly fees for insurance. You know, we have weekly fees for radio dues. I pay $78 a week in dues with Yellow Cab, $60 radio dues, $18 Yellow Cab dues, $35 a week with insurance. And a lot of us, like, I'm still paying for my car, so that's additional $125. And we can get repairs on credit, so that's going to be a minimum of $50. Because cars, if you're constantly using your car, you know, a car doesn't last forever. You're going to have to get it repaired.
Well, Carolyn, thanks for checking in. Appreciate it.
All right.
Carolyn Robinson is a taxi driver for Yellow Cab in the District of Columbia, and she joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Summer vacation, we used to come at this park very often. Not right now because, you know, we can't spend that much money on gas. Going and, like, come twice a week probably.
That's Amelia. She has two kids and a minivan. We caught up with her across from a local park here in Culver City, California. Despite soaring gas prices, truck and SUV sales were doing surprisingly well at the end of 2007. This year, it's a different story. With fuel prices moving past the $4 mark, sales of large vehicles finally hit a sharp bump in the road. Norris Bishton is feeling it. He owns Airport Marina Honda. That's a car dealership here in Southern California. Norris, how are you?
Doing well. Doing well.
Well, thanks for coming on. So I have a friend who might be interested in trading her big luxury gas-guzzling SUV for a more fuel-efficient car. What kind of trade value do you think she'd get in this market?
Well, her trade value is going down every day. As gas goes up, the trade value on low miles per gallon vehicles goes down. And it is, she should trade it in as quickly as possible, because every indication is that the values are going to continue to drop.
So when we talk about this business, you know, the Hondas are cars of many different styles. Are you finding that people are coming to you, and when they go on the lot, they gravitate towards the smaller cars these days?
Absolutely. Honda really doesn't, you know, it doesn't have, even its large vehicles are nowhere near the size of a Ford Expedition or Explorer. But even within the range of Honda vehicles, everybody is looking for more miles per gallon. They want to get more miles per gallon, and they will take much less vehicle than they used to take.
How hard is it to get huge SUVs off the lot for dealers?
Well, first of all, right now what's going on is dealers aren't getting them on the lot. They're not taking them in trade because they know they can't get them off the lot. That's one of the reasons that vehicle sales are so of new vehicles are down, is because dealers won't take the large SUVs in trade. Once you have them on your lot, you can just watch it drop in value sitting there on your lot due to the high gas prices.
We've heard of some African-American car dealerships shutting down, particularly if they sold luxury models. But in general, throughout the industry, you know, black, white, purple, what are you hearing from other people who run dealerships?
Well, first of all, the domestic dealerships are really hurting. Numerous Ford dealerships here in Southern California have shut down. I also have a Ford dealership, and it is surprising how few people are even coming in to look at the Ford product. So it is domestic dealerships tended to have more minority dealers, and those dealers are being hit particularly hard.
Do you think that there's going to be a long-term readjustment in terms of, you know, things have gone in waves. The big cars were part of one wave, but then back in the 70s, you had a wave of tiny little cars to deal with the fuel issues back then. Do you think we're going to see another wave of automakers deliberately making much smaller cars?
Any automaker who doesn't broaden its line of smaller cars is going to go out of business. The domestics cannot move to smaller vehicles fast enough, and that's part of their problem because it's costly to tool for new models. Some of the domestics, like Ford, I believe, are going to try to bring models they now produce and sell in Europe, which is much smaller, over here to the United States. But we've reached a point; consumers will not pay more than $4. A gallon for gas and put it into a big vehicle. That was the $4 was the turning point, and they just said no more.
Just quickly, do hybrids pay for themselves? Aside from all the other, you know, save the planet benefits, will they save your wallet in the long run?
Over time, yes, they will. But again, just as gas goes up, they'll pay for themselves faster. I heard this morning gas oil was at $143 a barrel. We expect here in California to see a $5 a gallon. I've seen $5 a gallon gasoline already in the stations. And I mean, if it goes to, as some people say, $6 and $7 and $8, a hybrid will pay itself off in a very short time.
Well, Norris, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Norris Bishton is a car dealer. He owns Airport Marina Honda here in Southern California, and he's also one of our supporters at NPR. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Last week, two popular hip-hop websites were hacked. When users clicked on SOHH.com and AllHipHop.com, they saw the regular content replaced with racist images and racial slurs. For the latest on the cyber attacks, we're joined by Felicia Palmer, CEO and president of 4Control Media Incorporated. That's the company that owns and operates SOHH.com. Felicia, good to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me. We appreciate it.
So tell us what happened on the site last week.
Well, I mean, what the culmination of a week of DDoS attacks, you know, it started off on Monday with DDoS attacks, and basically what that means is...
Please go ahead. I was about to ask you what that meant.
Yeah, what happens is, you know, they create, basically they send out little robots. They put robots on computers across the country, which make requests to your website, which essentially bring your website down because of an overload of requests. So a DDoS stands for denial of service, and they do that by basically clogging up your arteries, basically, with requests from robots that are not regular people and overwhelming your servers. So that started off on Monday, and that took about 60% of our site down. And then on Friday, it culminated with, what we call, I guess, a cross-scripting attack, which essentially they were able to hack into our system and place images of Hitler, Nazi swastikas, images of slaves with nooses around their necks, images of mutilated people. So that's what appeared on the site on Friday morning.
Now, I understand this has gone all the way to the FBI. What is the update on who these people are, and do you have any sense of where this case will go from here?
Well, you know, we don't want to provide too much information because at the same time, while we're doing this, we're waiting for them to strike again, and we're collecting data every time they reach us. They're giving us more data. But one thing I will tell you, these people are in the United States. They're roughly between the ages of 16 and 21. A few of them are based in Texas, Waco, Texas. And, you know, we know that these are young people who pretty much thought it was a joke. You know, who from what I understand, it all started from some sort of internet beef that they had with people who were on our forums and decided that they wanted to make this big production out of it. So, you know, it started off as some sort of joke, and now it's turned into, you know, interruption in our business and an FBI probe.
Do you think, your own personal opinion, that these are pranksters who are using the racial images as kind of a sidebar, or racists who are using technology?
Well, you know, it's interesting because at first I thought it was prank. They're definitely beyond pranksters. You know, they definitely have access and knowledge about attacking and hacking. So these are beyond pranksters. These guys do this for, this is what they do on a regular basis, and we're the target now. We became the target as a result of this kind of beef that was going on with some of our members. But we do know that this is a racist attack because the images we saw, the Nazi swastikas, the images of the slaves with the nooses and the mutilated bodies, in addition, the information that that the FBI and we have uncovered gives us access to conversations that they've had online, which they've been using the N-word, where they've talked about, you know, how their neighborhoods have been overrun by, you know, and sex and things of that nature. So, you know, people, you know, automatically saying, oh, we're trying to play the race card, but this is actually a racial issue because these people are attacking us and attacking us on the basis of who the site serves, which are predominantly, I mean, hip-hop serves all cultures, so it's a misnomer that people would think that it's a black website, but certainly African-Americans, Jewish people, Latinos, whites, everybody, you know, comes to the site, and I guess you know, they perceive it to be an African-American thing, or, you know, so they're attacking us on that basis as well.
Well, Felicia, thanks for the info, and we'll definitely follow up on this one.
Thank you for having us, and we'll keep you posted.
Felicia Palmer is the CEO and president of 4Control Media, which owns and operates SOHH.com. She joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Unity. It's not just a concept, but the name of a small town in New Hampshire. And that's where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama made their first public campaign appearance as buddies. Will this get us past some of the bickering of the primaries? For more, we have our bloggers roundtable. Joining us, Robert Redding, who blogs at thereddingnewsreview.com, Kay Tempest Bradford, who blogs at theangryblackwoman.com, and Ed Brown, who blogs for darkstarspoutsoff.typepad.com. Hi, folks.
Hey,
hello.
So we're going to talk about Clinton and Obama in a few minutes, but let's kick things off with a follow-up to the hacking of SOHH. You just heard Felicia explain the denial of service attacks. Tempest, what's your thought?
Well, this is something that I actually have a little bit of experience with, and it doesn't surprise me that there are hackers out there who are not only, you know, targeting website that they perceive that, that black people or Latino are frequenting, but doing so in a racialized way. My blog right now is on WordPress.com, and one of the reasons why I haven't moved off of WordPress to my own website, perhaps get advertising, is because WordPress.com is very protected. They have a lot of servers. They have websites that are far bigger and more important than mine that they have to protect, so they have great server protection. But I still sometimes get, you know, hordes and hordes of comments from people who are just angry at me because I'm black, because I'm a woman. And it just doesn't surprise me, seeing what I've gone through, and what I've gone through is small on the scale of attacks on the Internet.
Robert, this was not just so, as people call it, S-O-H-H. It was also All Hip Hop, and there may be other sites that are getting targeted as well. And do you think that this is a specific case of racial backlash, you know, perceiving these sites to be popular or influential in some way, they were taken out specifically for racial reasons? Or, you know, and I know it's speculation, but do you think it's just people trying to make a name for themselves, as some hackers do, by, you know, shutting things down and feeling very self-satisfied about it?
It might be a little bit of both. I think that this is definitely a cause for concern for black site operators such as myself, those on the conversation today and those online. I think that it's very unfortunate what's happened to our friends over at All Hip Hop and other sites, and I think that we should be very cautious. I know we're being very cautious over at Reading News Review. We just got off the phone with our folks making sure our security is up to par, and we just changed our passwords. We do that from time to time. I encourage people that are blogging to do that. Our good friends need our support right now. We're watching this very closely, and I think this is something that, of course, is targeted to the black community. Unfortunately, it really jives with what I've seen on a day-to-day basis for some time on the internet, which large media corporations, legacy media, continues to ignore. There is a racial hatred out there, an undercurrent in America. Sure, we see a lot of great progress with Barack Obama and what we've seen so far with hope and change in those messages and young people getting involved and really connected, but we still see a lot of people out there that really have a problem with progress.
Ed, have you ever had to deal with, you know, either spam, racist spam, or sort of, you know, message board issues in any of the sites you've worked with?
No, I haven't. I pretty much use, you know, well, I've used like Blogspot, and right now I'm using Typepad, so they pretty much handle it. And I did enable the captcha to try to cut down on the spam, but those sites that are, those companies that are, you know, manning their own sites and, you know, their own servers and things like that, you know, they really have to take care to be aware and to stay on the, you know, have the security updates and, you know, make sure they, you know, have an RSS feed or a daily look at, you know, the security postings that go along to try to combat this. This is just the tip of the iceberg, and, you know, right now they're going after people that they don't like, but the real thing that worries me about this is that they're going after big companies, they're going after banks, and some of these companies, from what I've read, are actually paying off these people without saying anything, you know, to the general public, and you know, this is really big business, especially from what I understand, the Russian mafia is behind a lot of this, and some of these other, you know, I guess groups or gangsters, really, cybernetic gangsters in Europe. This is a real big problem.
I want to move on, actually, to another topic, the question of unity. Friday, there was an Obama-Clinton unity rally in Unity, New Hampshire, if that's not enough unity for you. Tempest, do you think this rally was credible? That is, did they seem like they were actually buddies?
Well, they did seem like they were buddies. Whether or not they've actually buried whatever hatchet they had from the primary, I can't tell you. Basically, I have a general distrust of the process that forces people to fight with each other and say horrible things about each other, and then once finally one of them comes out on top, everybody says, oh, we loved him all along. But it's what you do in politics. It's once the Democratic nominee has been chosen, the Republican nominee, or whoever, the party is supposed to get behind them. So I think that it was good that, you know, we can finally say, okay, whether or not Hillary Clinton actually truly feels that she's in unity with Obama or not, at least she's making the public appearance of being so. She's doing what you're supposed to do in a political party, which is support the candidate.
Ed, do you think that this is going to get some of her supporters who were not so thrilled by Obama getting the nomination back on the Democratic bandwagon?
No, I don't, because I thought it would initially, but now it looks like some of them are really so hurt and rabid about, you know, Hillary and what they thought was a lot of sexism directed their way that they're just not going to come around. And there was some sexism coming their way, but from what I could tell, a lot of it came from other sources and not the Obama camp. I mean, if they want to be mad, they can be mad about, you know, what some people are calling false allegations of racism, but on sexism, I don't think they have a leg to stand on, and that's what many of them appear to be mad about.
Now, Robert, we didn't see Bill out there. There was unity, but, you know, I guess the tent wasn't big enough for Bill. Now, do you think that he was kept away deliberately because he had been the spark for some beef between the two camps? Or do you think it was just that, you know, they needed their private bonding time? And do you think Bill's going to come back and rejoin the rallying?
Well, we just filed a report on the website at Reading News Review about Bill and a meeting with Barack Obama that's been scheduled. So I think that that will happen shortly. I'm not sure whether that will be public or not. I will say that I don't think Bill Clinton needed to be there. I know much has been made about the fact that he wasn't there at Unity for Barack and Hillary. I think that he's caused enough of a stir, and she's the one that was running for president, so it was appropriate the way it was played out.
And what about you, Tempest? Do you think that Bill's going to get back in it?
I think so. I think that he, just like Hillary, wants to, you know, be part of this process, whatever that is, because this is their life. I don't think he's going to give that up. But I would like to say, just on a quick point about the Hillary supporters who are not going to, you know, back Obama, I think that there's definitely some legitimate concerns that they have about the sexism that came out during the campaign, whether or not it was from Obama's camp, whether or not it was just the media. And I definitely feel them, and I feel that it's not been properly addressed, the problems that came up in both campaigns, the racism and the sexism from both sides of the fence.
Well, who do you think should bring it up, or who do you think should fix it?
I think that they both need to bring it up. I think that separately, both of them need to sit down, because Obama gave that great speech about race, and I think that he needs to address the concerns that women have with the sexism, and Hillary needs to address the concerns that black people had with the racism that either came from people in her camp or people who were fired or whatever. Like, they both need to sit down and address those things, because otherwise nobody's going to move on. Everybody's still going to be angry about what came, you know, the many, many months before this.
All right, a little more lighthearted on politics. On our blog, NPR News and Views, back in April, we gave some suggestions on who we thought should play in the Obama biopic. We had people give us their thoughts. You know, it ranged from Regina King, you know, any number of people who could play Senator Clinton or Senator McCain. But particularly speaking of Obama, last week Will Smith told MTV that he would enjoy playing Barack Obama because they both have big ears. who are you guys leaning for? I'll start with you, Robert. Who would you want to play Obama?
Well, I think that we'll... Smith would be a good pick for Barack Obama. I can see the resemblance. We all look alike anyway, so why not?
Oh, boy. Tempest, what
being
about...
a little sarcastic.
I know you are. Tempest, what about McCain?
Oh, McCain, that one is hard. The only person I could really think of was Clint Eastwood, just because I feel that he could just you know, bring that strange gravitas to the role, and it would be funny.
He's too young, but I was thinking Michael Chiklis from, what was that, The Shield?
Oh, yes. He is too young, but he would probably be able to pull that off, too.
They can put some wrinkles on him. Ed, what about Hillary Clinton?
You know, that's a good one. I just drew a blank. The woman who played Murphy Brown.
Was that Candace Bergen?
Yes, I think she should do it. She would do a good job, I think.
All right, we've got a vote, an in-staff vote for Glenn Close as well. How quickly do you think somebody's going to rush something like this out, Robert? You know, do you think that we could see something in theaters in, like, summer of 2009?
Oh, absolutely. With Barack Obama's clear youth appeal and his connection to Hollywood, he just had a big fundraiser there, I think, last week. That mm-hmm. was very successful. I think it's very likely that we'll see a film, whether he doesn't win. If he doesn't win, if he does win, we'll definitely see a film. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we saw it next summer.
Okay, guys, on that note, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barack.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Robert Redding, who blogs at thereddingnewsreview.com, Kay Tempest Bradford, who blogs at theangryblackwoman.com, and Ed Brown, who blogs at darkstarspoutsoff.typepad.com.